Okay, we have some wonderful questions. I wish we could get to all of them. But I picked the hardest one for the panel. I think they were hoping to get the softballs, but we're going to take the first question, which was posed to everyone. What is your opinion of providing aid that is tied to government performance measures, i.e. transparency? And I certainly want to start with Ashraf because he has looked at these issues of how you measure a state's effectiveness. And let's see whether we would all agree on some indices or some way to hold governments accountable on the aid question.
Thank you. Claire Lockhart, my colleague, and I have just finished a book that deals with state effectiveness. And the core idea is that the modern state performs 10 functions in the political, economic, and social arenas. We have tested an approach that, since we were in Kosovo, for instance, 2 weeks ago, and villagers, what is an incredible ease, grading the performance of the government and the international authority. We have to, understanding states is actually not rocket science, provided one begins with a citizen perspective, because they are the people who make the ultimate judgment as to whether things are going right or things are going wrong. So we have to begin with that fundamental point. Then on the question of what we are arguing is to replace the double failure of the aid and ineffective corrupt governments with a double compact. A compact between citizens and their states and a compact between the states and the international community. And this has to be rights and obligations on both sides. Designing systems of accountability is core to this. Public money has to be used for public purpose. And when 80% of a country's budget is stolen in the process of being transferred, that is not something that should be tolerable. So I think we need to come. The issue, however, is, you know, this will shock you. None of the developmental organizations has a manual for how to run a Ministry of Finance. Right? You had to invent it, I had to invent it.
Correct.
They shouldn't, but they should have assisted with the lessons. You know, I asked the IMF and the World Bank two questions. What should the Ministry of Finance do? What should it not do? All they brought me after 6 months were other cases of failure. But when one looks in the last 40 years, I think there's been enormous advance, whether it's been Singapore, whether it's been Ireland, or whether it's been the American South, where severe problems of governance have been overcome. We need to learn from these, and transparency is key.
Paul, you want performance measures?
Governments should be accountable to their citizens, not to their donors. So that water should not be muddy. However, donors have got an important role in ensuring and insisting that governments are accountable to their citizens. And so I agree with Ashraf that donors should not be telling governments what policies to do or how they should spend money, on what they should spend money, but they should be conditioning on the basic processes of accountability. And Ngozi there reported to the citizens what the Ministry of Finance was passing to governors of the states in Nigeria. And I think, Ngozi, you had two responses to that. One was death threats, and the other was newspaper circulation in Nigeria spiked the day you published the numbers because people wanted to know. Right? So that's the sort of thing that donors can reasonably insist on a transparent budget. Paddy Ashdown, who was at the practical coalface of doing this sort of thing in post-conflict environments, said, what I need is not Médecins Sans Frontières, it's Accountants Sans Frontières.
Huh? Betty, one of the questions that came up for you, and it was a question that others and Reverend Jackson raised when he came up, infrastructure in post-conflict environments is critical. But then what happens to the issues, and the question for you was justice and reconciliation as one example. Can you be going down multiple tracks of rebuilding roads, but also repairing relations between communities that have now become enemies of sorts?
I would say that it's not either or. All are very important. But since the issue of justice and reconciliation has come up, let me focus on that. In that, in post-conflict situation, typical post-conflict situation, people are deeply scarred. There's deep distrust in one another. And therefore, reconciliation is extremely important. And sometimes I even say that before you prepare people for the development, take them to the development path, they need to be reconciled, to be talking to one another, to have shared views and be able to prioritize their needs instead of, you know, immediately packing your bags and giving them checks. At the same time, I would say that justice is equally important because how do victims in a post-conflict situation, how do they perceive justice? If you have butchered my entire family, like the case, what we've seen in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and northern Uganda, and Sudan as well, you know, that that in the name of reconciliation or in the name of amnesty, that the perpetrator is let loose on the street, and in some cases, like I've seen in rehabilitation, that the development partners go in and they're trying to rehabilitate children who have participated in war or generally all their rehabilitation and totally neglecting victims or people who have not participated in war so that it appears like the very people who are responsible for the deaths and destruction are being rewarded. And so some people would ask the question like, oh, because we didn't participate in war, we didn't kill, so nobody is caring for us. So I'm saying this because there's need to balance these things. So if you butcher my family and I see you being rewarded because you're a former combatant, that has now come out, you're being rehabilitated, and nothing is, you know, I don't have a family anymore, I don't have property anymore, certainly it's going to hurt my feeling even more and probably will turn into use my own means. I've heard people say, victims say, well, I still have young sons growing up. They will one day revenge. So for the sake of sustainable peace, you need to put emphasis in this, in that people have to learn to live together with one another while rebuilding the economy. Thank you.
One of the other tough questions for all three of you are about investment guarantees. What are the best ways to provide investment guarantees for foreign investment to be stimulated in post-conflict contexts?
Begin with Pakistan?
No.
First, OPEC in the United States is a very good instrument. We began with $50 million, and they had to be ordered. Now the floor is $1 billion, and there's no interest. Europeans did not come to the table. I failed completely to get Hermes. So it's a series of instruments, and MIGA was the worst. I had to pay $5 million of our own hard-earned cash to secure MIGA, and it took them 3 years. They need to really change in terms of, one has to shift the attitude from aid to creation of the market instruments. $1 from some of the donors is worth 10 cents on the ground to me, because 90 cents of it gets to be captured back. So the first thing we need to do on aid is to inform the citizens of the United States and other countries as to how much of their aid is actually going to their intended countries and how much is being captured by the Beltway. Unless the aid complex in some of the developed countries is broken, we are not going to get the objectives of peace and security. Prior to 9/11, you could say support, subsidize the private sector. It's the most ineffective face of the private sector. Second is technical assistance. Technical assistance today is the most unregulated industry next to extractive industry. And unlike the extractive industry, there is not even an initiative, a transparency initiative. $5 billion a year in technical assistance is going to Africa. No investment, 4 years of that investment could change the face of African education fundamentally. And we need to shift towards capacity. And in terms of guarantees, foreign guarantees are essential for foreign investment. But the most significant guarantee is for national investment. In Lebanon, for instance, all foreign investment is guaranteed. Not a single guarantee for local Lebanese investment. So what's the result? $80 billion was on deposit in Lebanese banking system last year when I did the stock taking after the war. No investment. We have to be able to create a system of guarantees to venture capital funds and others that allows the money to be used. In my last observation, the world is awash with money. There's so much money in Afghanistan or Sudan or other places. It's really striking. But it's not becoming capital. And the key to transforming it into capital is to create these instruments that then can be used to create meaningful jobs.
Thank you. I'll turn it over to Gail to summarize all the findings from the tables.
And the finding from this side table is that we should put this panel in charge of organizing the international community's response to post-crisis situations. I think our tables really did come up with a lot that is in the space of solutions. So let me go through this quickly. It'll also be on the screens behind me. We have established a Training Without Borders program that could respond quickly and flexibly to crisis situations to develop the skills necessary, especially among youth, to kickstart the economy and reconstruction. That's where you can put the Accountants Without Borders.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Employ the military in reconstruction efforts, swords to plowshares. Institute leapfrogging technologies that rapidly reach a broad set of constituencies. Wireless internet, cell phones, we've heard examples of these. They can be deployed very quickly, as we've heard. You don't have to wait. Continuing, fund community empowerment initiatives that focus on youth employment, apprenticeships, and education. And again, tie this to what Betty and others talked about, thinking down the road, what is Country X going to need, and use these initiatives to support that. Support and improve the capacity of financial institutions everywhere. Financial institutions tailored to post-conflict challenges, and streamline access to investment capital, provide risk insurance, and other tools. This is really strategically important. If there were packages of flexible financial tools available post-conflict, a lot more could happen a lot more quickly. Build a digital post-conflict knowledge base that shows best practices and case studies, engaging local citizens and worldwide journalists and academics. A really interesting point here is to engage some other than the usual suspects, not just the professional analysts, but reporters who look at this, academics who study this, and also local people who are at the other end, quite frankly, of our goodwill, but as we described earlier, chaotic goodwill. Finally, a couple of gems. The first is to create a Nobel-type award with money for exceptional individuals who make a difference in post-conflict situations. This is a great idea. We've got the Nobel Peace Prize, which gets people recognized for getting the agreement done. But this is about recognizing the people who consolidate and move into the future. It would be a great way to give visibility to the importance of this phase. The other is sponsor local and national sports teams with resources for equipment and travel, sports inspire community building for reconciliation. I was in Liberia recently, and one of the greatest things I saw was the soccer teams that were from all different factions in Liberia. And it was, as I think you all know from your work, the one thing that pulls people together, even if I today still don't understand football. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to you. And thanks. These are really, really great solutions from all of you.
Thank you, Gail. We'll get some reactions, starting with Paul, to some of these, and we'll go around. And as we react, also your closing thoughts, which I think we're probably moving towards. So, Paul.
I was really impressed by these ideas. Let me say, one of the first recipients of the GEM Award would be Betty. I was just in Uganda 2 weeks. I was just in Uganda 2 weeks ago. I turned on the local radio, and they were discussing the dangers of further conflict in the north. They've just discovered oil in Uganda, in about the most disastrous place on earth, underneath Lake Albert, in between northern Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, right? And the border isn't adjudicated. And it was a phone-in broadcast, this radio broadcast. Somebody phoned in and said, "What we need is Betty Bagombi." I particularly liked the Training Without Borders program. I think that hits to the heart of a lot of issues, because one of the questions to me was about what are the other constraints, and there's a broader capacity constraint. There's a skill constraint across the board in these societies. A capacity constraint within government, which is very severe indeed, and a skills shortage within the society, because the skilled people have left. Right? They hemorrhage emigration of skilled people during conflict. So part of the establish a Training Without Borders is to pull in the skilled diaspora to be both to return home to use its skills and to be part of that training process. I think in Afghanistan you actually tried that, but usually it's not tried. So I'd like to congratulate you on some really innovative thinking. It's tragic that in a few moments you can come up with things that are really innovative. If you think about it, it shows how feeble the intellectual effort has been on this vital topic.
Are you going to steal some of these ideas? If you wanted to comment briefly, and then I'll let Betty close and have some final thoughts.
I think, again, compliments to everybody. It shows the wisdom of a group. This is precisely what I was talking about, the network approach, rather than an individualized approach. Because we have to shift from a charismatic view of change to system building. You know, the Japanese have built fantastic systems, but the inheritors of three great world religions and other traditions still believe in the prophet to deliver. We cannot count on charisma. We have to build up systems. And it's part of that that this Training Without Borders becomes so fundamentally important. Let me mention one neglected community that could play an incredibly role. Lawyers who would negotiate with and on behalf of some of the poorest countries of the world.
Absolutely.
We literally lose our shirts in negotiations because the legal playing field is totally uneven. In Afghanistan, when I was away for a country briefly, for a dollar, 60 years of concessions for oil had been granted, violating our constitution, etc. You know, we stopped it. But, you know, what kind of corruption takes place in this field? The second issue that I really want to highlight, that's been highlighted here, is the question of design of infrastructure. Leapfrogging in design is absolutely essential because a lot of the infrastructure that has been being designed for the poorest countries of the world is design of 60 years ago. Those standards need to be revisited in leapfrogging technologies becomes essential. Concluding point in this, without power, without electricity, you are not going to get empowerment of women, you're not going to get children to learn, and you're not going to facilitate access of the most remote rural communities to the market. So it becomes really important to think through about rethinking the grid and alternative sources of energy. Nepal, in this regard, is really a great example. 35% of Nepal's villages now have micro-hydro-based power. And what is really important to use carbon trading fund as a mechanism to get to the communities directly. So we need a global and a local linkage that bypasses a lot of the complexities of development institutions that have created such huge bureaucracies that then decision makings are arrogated rather than shared.
Thank you. Betty, some closing thoughts?
Yeah. First of all, I'd like to congratulate all of you for these proposals that have come, that you've given to us. I think you've all become experts in post-conflict interventions. I want to just underscore what Paul touched on, and that is on capacity, and specifically capacity in government in a typical post-conflict situation. And I would give my own example that I remember after all the wars Uganda had gone through, and we came into government. And when we came into government, the appointments were not based on merits. Appointments are usually based on who fought most, which faction has a leader, which rebel group, the leader of the armed groups have to be included in the government or in cabinet so that they feel important and do not go out to start war again. So in a typical post-conflict situation, capacity of the government is extremely weak. And so I remember UN delegations coming, World Bank, NGOs, and we were just giving out shopping lists. We didn't even know the difference between NGOs and the UN. And so immediately you're tasked with dealing with a very complex situation of rehabilitation without being adequately prepared to know how to deal with that situation. And this is sometimes where we do not achieve our objectives. Just a little mention of what has come in here. I think it's about the empowerment of the community. I just want to emphasize that is certain empower of community to community initiatives that focus on youth employment, apprenticeship, and education. I think that's one very important way of building sustainable peace. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to close by thanking our panelists. I'm reminded sitting here of the parable of the man who's lost in the forest for 3 days, wandering, and finally sees another man, and maybe you all know this, and he says, "Thank goodness you'll lead me out." And the other man says, "I've been wandering in this forest for 3 days myself." And there's a long pause. And then it dawns on them, well, if we pair up together, we know the roads we've already tried. Perhaps together we'll find the path forward. And I hope with all your help and yours, we will find a path forward. So thank you to all three of you. I now have the pleasure of introducing and saying a few words about this session's commitment certificate presenter, and I am honored, really, to say a few words about Antonio Guterres, our United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. As you know, he's the former Prime Minister of Portugal from 1996 to 2002. He spearheaded efforts to resolve the crisis in East Timor. He was president of the European Council, during which time he chaired the first EU-Africa Summit. Would you join me in welcoming the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you very, very much for this debate and for the commitments that are very central to what I do now. The most rewarding activity of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is to help people come home. 12 people come home voluntarily, in safety and dignity. And in 2007, in the first half, we have helped about 500,000 people go back to Afghanistan, to Burundi, to southern Sudan. But it causes us an enormous dilemma. Because we have to ask ourselves, even if they do it voluntarily and refugees want to go back home, what is going to happen to them? And many of the refugees of yesterday will become the migrants of tomorrow because there is nothing they can do to rebuild their lives in the countries where they go back home. This is a big challenge for the countries themselves, and of course capacities are necessarily not yet there in a post-conflict situation. But it is an enormous challenge for the international community, and I'm speaking now mainly of the community of donor countries, of the international financial organizations, and the UN system, because let's be honest, this group does not know how to address these situations. They tend to do business as usual, as if it was a normal development process. It is not the case. And so the interventions massively fail. And that is why these commitments are very important, because they help to build the knowledge base for a different way for the international community to address these situations and to effectively help these countries to rebuild their futures. And the first commitment comes from Ashraf Ghani, chairman of the Institute for State Effectiveness, and Claire Lockhart, executive director of the same institute. A commitment of $40 million to building mechanisms to create wealth and prosperity for the world's poor while promoting approaches that will tackle climate change. And the Institute is creating and implementing national frameworks and programs for public financial management which unlock hidden sources of wealth and revenue for the world's poor. These mechanisms will link the imperative to address global warming and the increased investment available to governments to reduce poverty. Resources will be mobilized to create sustainable jobs around the implementation of energy, transportation, water and housing programs in the poorest countries. And this program will directly impact the citizens of 5 of the poorest countries in the world. The second commitment comes from a Swiss company, Swiss reinsurance company. For me, working in Geneva today is a particularly happy thing to do. And a commitment of developing, structuring, pricing and implementing financial risk transfer solutions, providing protection for low-income people in developing countries from drastic events related to climate change and other unexpected external forces. It's a commitment of $20 million over 14 months, and I call Mr. Christian Mumenthaler, yes, the Chief Risk Officer. Now, the company will develop new financial risk transfer instruments with the aim of providing up to $18 million of weather risk protection for small farmers in the developing world. And as a pioneer in risk insurance, the company will offer its expertise and dedicated team of specialists to develop, structure, price, and implement these innovative financial solutions that support adaptation to the consequences of climate variability in low-income countries. As a result, 600,000 people will get additional protection. Now, the last commitment I would call Richard C. Blum, chairman of the Blum Capital Partners, George Scharfenberger, executive director of the Blum Center for Developing Economies of the University of California, and Erica Stone. Are you around? Yes. Well, this commitment of the Blum Center for Developing Economies and the Center for Information Technology Research in the Interest of Society, CITRIS, of the University of California, is to increase access to tools of communication by lowering costs for the underserved and expanding the service reach of existing telephone operators. $5 million over 5 years, and aiming to alleviate the burden of poverty and to increase access to information by lowering the costs of communications for the underserved and expanding the service reach of existing telephone operators. And by developing a new generation of cell phones and the implementation of new services, working to empower and help lift 1 billion underserved, illiterate, and remote rural residents out of poverty. All the best. Thank you very much. This was a wonderful session.
And if you may, enjoy your break, and we hope to see you back here this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, working session 3 is now concluded. The plenary session will begin at 12:30.